The Essential Atari ST, Mitchtron's Time Bandit from 1986, coming up next. Hi, this is Jeff, 8-Bit Rocket, and today we begin a new video and audio podcast series. On Into the Vertical Blank's The Essential Atari ST, we investigate, discuss, and evaluate Atari ST computer games and try to uncover titles worthy of play by all who are interested in the platform. We are also looking for gems in 80s computer libraries that bridge or fill the gap between the American video game crash and the NES era and beyond. Do games released in the pre-NES era hold relevance or value to gamers today? Before the NES era helped redefine what players expect from gaming, tens of thousands of games were released across a number of computer and console platforms. Which of these games should players who only grew up on NES and beyond consider trying out? So coming up next, I discuss the history and details of Time Bandit and bring in my brother Steve, Fulton Dot, as we further go over the gameplay, legacy, and its merits as an essential Atari ST title.
Hey Jeff, what are we doing today?
Today is the first episode of a new podcast called The Essential. This is The Essential Atari ST, and today we're going to be doing a game for the Atari ST, going in depth on the game Time Bandit for the Atari ST. Now, The Essential will have other podcasts. We'll go Atari 7800, 5200, maybe 5200, Atari 8-bit, Lynx, Jaguar, some other systems too. And this is where we're going to cover one game in depth.
One game in depth. And this is The Essential Atari ST Time Bandit.
We are going to talk about the game, what you do in the game from the instructions point of view, some reviews and things, and then we're going to give our feelings about the game, and at the end, we're going to discuss, for all the games we do, whether or not this game would be a good game for people for people Nintendo generation up to try out. Like, does it bring anything to the table? Is it just a score-chasing game? And that's for all of the games we do.
Is it an essential game to play? Is it an essential game to go back and replay now, right?
Right.
Like, there something interesting about it that makes it an essential game to understand the platform if that's what you want to do?
Before we go any further, let's start with a little bit of history of the Atari ST and Mitchtron. Many early games were produced for the 520 and 1040 machines from 1985 to 1988. For the first few months of the ST's life, the games of Mitchtron, based in Michigan, were some of the only titles available. Some of these games took full advantage of the ST's powerful 16-bit capabilities, and some were nothing more than 8-bit games with a new coat of colorful paint. In 1986, Time Bandit, Major Motion, and Mud Pies were the first titles I remember seeing discussed in magazines such as Antic, Analog, and Atari Explorer. Enticed by the look of these games, and by the need to move on to the next generation of computer systems, we sold all of our Atari 800 gear in late 1986, and even with the fire sale, we didn't scrape together enough cash needed for the 16-bit system right away. With the hope of some birthday money in January 1987, we plan to purchase a system and make our 16-bit gaming dream a reality, a 520 ST with mono monitor hooked up to a TV for color games. With a month or two lag in between computers and games, we had ample time to read over every magazine article and advertisement for Atari ST games. The name Mitchtron was everywhere from the start, so we start here too. Mitchtron published and distributed many games over the course of its short history. The company was initially named Computer Shack, but rumor has it that they changed the name after pressure from Radio Shack in 1984. founded in 1982 by high school friends Gordon Monnier and Bill Dunleavy to market Bill's TRS-80 and Sanyo targeted titles, they would expand to other platforms soon after. The most notable game in the early years was a very well-respected TRS-80 classic called Time Bandit, which would be translated to the Atari ST and Amiga a few years later. Bill was very taken with the capabilities of the new 16-bit Atari computers, and in 1985 decided to translate some of his games to the system, and then solicit and market games from other like-minded developers. Mistron became affiliated with UK-based Microdeal in 1987 to co-market and distribute each other's games, especially as the stateside market for ST games started to dry up. Microdeal produced a number of good ST games that we might feature in this series. Mistron moved on to create some very well-respected ST development tools, but declining sales in the USA and eventually the UK led to its demise, and it was sold to Creative Computer Corp in 1991. A basic info about Time Bandit. Time Bandit is a 2D overhead scrolling action adventure game. It got a USA release, which you can't say for most Atari ST games. It is actually, the USA release was the first release. It got a UK release, and it was in 1986. Got a UK release in 1986. It got a German release in 1986. Also, three different companies released this across the world. You wouldn't see that now. It is an American game. The programmers were, the programmer was Bill Dunleavy, and the artist was Larry Hafner. And it was on 1/2 meg disc. They crunched a lot of data because they had to make it work with that first Atari ST disc drive that was 1/2 meg.
Okay. See, I didn't think this was a UK. I thought this was a UK game when I looked at it.
Time Bandit is an American release.
It's American release, but what about the program? Like,
the guys worked on the TRS-80 first, so they're Americans. Yeah, all Mistron was American, done in Michigan, too.
Okay, interesting.
So the box and the disc. So I have some box and disc pictures. We'll show them right now. These come from Atari Mania, so thank you, AtariMania.com. It's a cool-looking one. I don't think we ever found this to purchase, though.
No, and if we did, it was in a blue box. There was a blue box, as far as I know, with Time Bandit, not a red box.
Okay.
So that's what I remember. But I don't think it was ever for sale anywhere.
No.
Or we would have bought it, because we bought Leatherneck, and we bought another one as well.
We bought all the games we could. If we could find it, we'd buy it. We bought Better Dead Than Alien. We bought all the... if you could find it in the USA and it was a good game, we would have purchased
it. It's funny you said Better Dead Than Alien, because a lot of the sounds in this sound like they're from Better
Dead
Than
Alien. I saw that in your notes. It's funny, because this was one of the first ST games that we saw, but when I went through looking for reviews, it took a while for a review to come out of this, and I kind of remember this and Major Motion... And that Major Motion, which is a game like Spy Hunter, and Mud Pies, which is sort of a very 8-bitty version of Food Fight, and mixed with Berserk. I thought these all came out about the same time, but it looks like Time Bandit came out a little bit later, or it was previewed and then the release came out a lot later. But still, 1986 is still really early in the ST's life.
Why did I think that Time Bandit was not made by Americans? It might have been the title screen. Oh, okay. Because it said, you can write to the authors Bill Dunleavy and Harry Lefner, CEO Microdeal, and then it had the address of Microdeal in Cornwall. That's why I thought
I got it. Because you're seeing the only directions, the only instructions that are there are from the British, the UK release. You don't have on Atari Mania, they don't have the US release instructions. The instructions start out with this line: legend and lore of the Time Game War.
Time Game.
So basically, the first page of the instructions rhyme, so I really didn't take it seriously.
I know, it's like a poem. The whole thing's a poem.
It's a poem. I got it. It's a poem. But it's kind of funny. Because, they had to make things rhyme. So when you have to make things rhyme, it doesn't really fit the game that well, but time gates are built by powerful people to explore time and space. The instructions are a rhyming poem, so I can't take them seriously. You're right.
Only the first page is a rhyming poem.
I know, just the first page. Essentially, you're the Time Bandit, and you must travel from castle to Starship to Desert and many more, and finally conquer 4D, the most ominous place.
Okay, I just want to say this. So the fact that there's a poem in the first page, the fact that this game has crammed so much into it, I feel like this is like someone's magnum opus. This is Bill Dunleavy's magnum opus. He threw everything into this game he could possibly think of. That's what I feel 100%
agree. And it goes into the game design, too, and everything that's in it. You can tell that these guys, they started this game out on the TRS-80, and then they got to the ST and said, we have room to do everything we want to do.
That's right. You start on an overhead world map while trying to enter time gates. You don't have to try. You just do it. Except there's some that are kind of hidden that I couldn't get to. Yes, so maybe you get to a new time gate land and you are trapped there. You're trapped until you can find the key to get out. Objectives: you must fire your missiles, find keys to open pulsating locks, and find the way out. And in some cases, there's also other stuff to do there too, like learning certain information for later. Right. Anyway. Right.
We'll go through some of that in here. So gameplay, more gameplay. Special objects in lands. You'll find things like one-way doors, ladders and pits to upper and lower levels, red transporter discs to other locations, and text adventures.
Yes,
you start with 10 lives. I played an unlimited lives version. You collect treasures and shoot all guardians for score. And you earn extra lives at 10,000 points. That's not going to matter. The video we see playing of the game is me playing the game for about an hour with unlimited lives. So
I would say that if you're going to play this game, play with unlimited lives and with the save game in your emulator. It's the only way to play it.
Right.
And we'll explain later why I think the game's not successful, and that's one of the reasons.
Right.
Each of the 16 lands has 16 levels, 4 phases and 4 sub-levels to conquer before you can finish the game. So it says 16 times 16, right?
That's a lot.
That's a lot of levels, right?
Yeah.
I think it's 256,
it's actually. It's a lot of levels.
So that's a lot of levels, and it's a lot. Monsters appear from portals like the monster generators. So we're going to get to
the game design. Yeah, exactly. Some levels have puzzles to solve to get rewards or to escape. You can collect scrolls, artifacts, and other clues, and you can read them. Now, I don't know if there's anything else to collect. Like, I didn't see anything like spells or weapons or anything. So the scrolls, I think, are just text. But there are even some text adventure-like questions. These may require 2 or 3 word clauses usually get and use. There's more than that, though. Like, you had to answer questions like,
there's some places where it asks you for a code and you have to collect the code information and stuff like that.
The spaceship levels were really interesting. There were some that were very elaborate. Can you describe a little bit about what you do in this game, basically, when you started up this game?
Yeah, okay, so this is what you do in this game. You run around using the joystick or the keyboard. I use the keyboard. You can actually play 2 people at the same time if you want.
Yes, you can.
As well, which is another thing they threw in. It literally is one of the first cooperative games. You think of it, one of the first like 16-bit cooperative action game where you run around and I'm sure by the time this came out, Gauntlet had come out because it's very, very influenced by Gauntlet.
Gauntlet had come out, I think.
It had in 1985. So
Time Bandit was released in 1986, created by Larry Hafner and Bill Dunleavy. It's an action-adventure maze-based shooter that too often has been mistaken as a Gauntlet clone. From an interview AtariLegend.com did with Harry Lafner, Harry said, "Actually, the game was originally called Pharaoh and was heavily based on the arcade game Tutankham. In fact, it even predates Gauntlet, having been a TRS-80 and Sanyo game in 1982. And the Gauntlet arcade game was released in 1985 by Atari, based on an Atari 8-bit game named Dandy." Well, if you have 2 people on the screen at the same time, the Time Bandit screen goes away and you have 2 separate scrolling screens. Each person, they kind of have to stay in the same land. But they're independent.
Okay.
It's pretty cool.
I wasn't able to try with 2 people. So you walk around these, because you start out on a scrolling map and you kind of walk onto these time lands. And there's a bunch of them, and some of them are harder to get to than others. And then each land is a different theme, with different graphics, different enemies, and different things to do. And then they all have a key. You're supposed to find key or keys that you need to then get out. And to find those keys, you know, sometimes you have to answer questions. Sometimes you have to find stuff. Sometimes there's little puzzles. There are so many little sprites in this thing. And they're all sort of from a 3D perspective, like a three-quarter perspective, in a way that it's incredibly impressive how many graphics are in this game. It's crazy. Then each level also scrolls. Sometimes they're bigger than you think they are. And you have to run for the monsters and shoot them. You don't want to get hit because you only have 10 levels. They have monster generators in Gauntlet, but you can't destroy them, which is disappointing to me. I feel like that could have been part of the strategy, was to destroy them.
Yes. We'll get to some of those criticisms. Yeah.
But then when you leave, every time you come back to, so if you finish a land and then you go back to that time land, it's the next level. And each, you're supposed to try to finish each of the 16 levels of each of the 16 lands, and then supposedly there's an ending. I don't know if anyone's ever seen it. Maybe they have.
There's even more to it then, though, because some of the lands have multiple levels to go up and down also in them. Mm-hmm. So you're in 1A, but you have to go up and down to find the keys and stuff. So it's even more. It's big. So it's very expansive. It's very much Gauntlet-like, in quotes. It's Gauntlet-like because of the hordes of enemies and what you're doing, but they've added more to it. They should have let you blow up the monster generators, which would have been good, because all you get is a constant horde of respawning enemy. And I know it makes the game a challenge. It's too challenging unless you have a multiple.
I would have rather you had limited ammo, had to pick it up, and were able to destroy the monster generators. It would have made more of a challenge that way too. The way it is, and we'll get to it.
On this screen, take a look at the screen. So this is the first screen of one of the gates. This is called Castle Greymoon. There's quests in this that people give you text quests you have to do. Yeah. But I just want to look at the screen for a second. You earn qubits. It must just be points, because I tried to give, someone wanted some money for something in one of the levels. I tried to pay him in qubits and they said, I don't know what that is. I also don't know what Brave 30 means, because in different lands you get these different things. I understand what Castle Greymoon and 1A means. That's the level. That's 1A of Greymoon. But the other stuff isn't explained, I don't think. We can look through the instructions again and see, but none of that's really explained.
By the way, there's a copyright on there. Right on time, it says 1985, so they might have finished it then.
So this was previewed in magazines in 1985. There's an overworld which I'll show on video right now,
right,
running around. You go to the overworld, and then some time gates you just walk on top of, some just run into you while you're walking around. So let's go to the next one that I didn't get them all. Okay, so here's King's Crown.
Uh-huh.
And King's Crown is sort of, you're in a castle.
Yes.
But also, the graphics in this are kind of, if you look at the colors, they share some graphics. It shares graphics with Castle Greymoon. So that's a little, and there's that, those eyeballs show up everywhere, by the way.
I love the eyeballs, by the way. That's why they show up everywhere.
Shooting the eyeballs is awesome. Okay, so the next one that I found was Underworld Arena, which
I love this
shares,
one.
Sorry.
I love the arena for some reason.
Underworld Arena, which is like an arena, but even if some of them look similar, there's unique enemies. Even if they share some enemies, there's unique enemies in all of
them. Yeah, everything's really cool. There's something unique or all unique in every one of these.
In every one, right, exactly. And different game types, too. I mean,
they're all like this one.
Shadowland.
The Pac-Man land.
Is Pac-Man, which is pretty damn cool.
Yeah, I liked it. I liked the
Pac-Man
land.
It's actually one of the best scrolling Pac-Man games on the Atari ST.
There's
good ones, but it's a really good one. Okay, so Omega Complex, I think, is a giant spaceship with little robots and these weird
diamonds. When you pick up those diamonds, I think everything, all the monsters pause. Freeze.
Diamonds may just get you more qubits too. I'm not sure. They might.
Something you pick up makes them freeze.
Oh yeah, okay. I think that's in the instructions. I have some more information about that. Let's see if we can find that. Major Hazard is another one, and to me, this looked a little bit like Doctor Who, just a little bit. There's another one that looks like it too. Like there's these little robots and stuff, but it's another one kind of in the future. Like you can't really tell what time that one and the last one are in. It's a future time. There is Cheops Curse, which is Egypt. Shares some of the graphics, but this is one of my favorite ones. Gridville, which is another weird Doctor Who one where you're on a grid. I mean, that's what you're on. You're on a grid, but it's a grid with weird monsters to shoot. It's similar graphics to the two major
Each
hazards.
One of these levels scrolls probably 5 screens wide and 3 screens high, at least, something right,
At least.
So they're huge. They're pretty huge big. Levels.
Old Bomb Factory. So this is an interesting one. I would get the Old Bomb Factory. It would attack me when I was in the overworld, and I'd get to the Old Bomb Factory. So I probably went there 4 or 5 times.
That's funny.
Ghost Town, which is Western, and it has a text adventure in the graveyard.
Yes. It's so strange. But not bad strange, just interesting.
There's a Sentinel. I can't tell what time this is. It's ancient time of some sort. Welkin Island. Don't know what this is. This looks neat. This one has, it's brand spanking new, like all different stuff. This one is the swirly one that you get to. And then there's the Excalibur. This is a space cruiser you're on. Some similar graphics to some of the other ones, but you're on a space cruiser and there's an adventure. There's text instructions and things you need to turn on, and there's like quests in this one. This one seems to be like one that Bill and Harry wanted to make a separate game, and they just threw it into here also.
I don't think that one. I literally don't think that one is a separate game. I swear to God, Bill Dunleavy, and to some extent Harry Lefner, he threw everything he ever wanted to do in a game.
That's what I mean. He wanted to make another game. He just said, "Let's put it all in this game."
Yeah,
And then, let's see, Dark Side Dare, which is a really weird-looking one where everything's kind of shaking. And lots of weird little green creatures to shoot, money to collect. And Hotel California, which looks similar to some of the other ones, but it's like a Western, kind of a California culture-style one. old California culture. And the Omega Complex, which I thought this was the final one, but I'm not sure because it's not 4D. But Omega Complex is another space-themed one.
Originally, I thought 4D might be a final level, but now I think 4D just means the 16th level of each one of the lands.
And the two-player game. Do you want to read about the two-player game, Steve?
Yeah, two-player game. Two players work together to solve the game. Players play in the same lands, but in their own windows. If one player's game is over, he will haunt the other player as the Dark Shadow.
Now, that's pretty awesome. Controls, the arrow keys in space or fire and the joystick. Escape to leave dialogue boxes. That's pretty self-explanatory, kind of. P for time stop spell. That's just his pause. They called it a time stop spell. It's one of the few places in the instructions that weren't part of the poem where they kind of added some other things,
right?
You know, sort of context. The pivot, stop in place, hold a button down and stay in place and fire in all directions. Just like Food Fight. When you're throwing the watermelon.
Oh, cool.
Okay, so here's some critics' reviews.
Before we get to the critics' reviews, here's something I wrote about the game about 15 years ago. Let's see if I still feel the same. So, how does the Atari ST version of Time Bandit shape up? Even though the graphics are relatively simple but well done, the gameplay and action in this title was some of the first to show off the capabilities of the new Atari machines. The goal in each of the 16 beautifully crafted lands is to collect artifacts and blow stuff up. The lands vary in theme through various recognizable time periods such as ghost towns and Egyptian ruins. You start with 14 lives and receive an extra life after you collect 1,000 qubits. You can earn qubits by solving puzzles, collecting artifacts, and shooting stuff, like snakes and hilarious rolling eyeballs. There's even a level that contains an entire text adventure to play through. I must have played this game for days on end, and the colorful graphics and humorous sprites made the game very enjoyable to play.
I could only find 3
English language ones, those are the only ones I considered, because usually the German and French ones came out much later and they wouldn't have had the game in context.
But right.
The critics' reviews. Atari ST user, July 1986. This is really early in that magazine's life and the ST's life. A 9 out of 10. It's so early in the ST's life that they have to warn you that it requires a color monitor. They expect that it has a chance to stand the test of time as an ST classic. And that's why it's in this podcast.
Right.
Okay, do you want
to read it? It should be.
It should be. Okay. Critics continued, Steve.
Page 6, Atari user, issue number 22. Rating, no scores at this time. They call it a maze shooter like Wizard of War, which it is, but it's obviously a more advanced version of Gauntlet or 8-Bit Dandy or even Chip's Challenge, but I'm not sure when that game came out.
Yeah, but for an Atari 8-Bit magazine, they should have recognized Dandy. That's all
I'm saying. Yeah. But highly recommended. Think twice about digging up tombstones in the graveyard.
That was their hint. I found one more. ST log. I had to actually search high and low to find this review because it wasn't in my review database that I had created. They called it outstanding. This was from December 1986. They said it's outstanding. Time Bandit represents a truly outstanding feat, an arcade game with action, variety, attention to detail, and fantastic graphics. Harry Lafner and Bill Dunleavy, the authors, can be proud of this one.
I agree about that. They should be proud of it.
They should be proud of it. Okay, I'll go through the ports. I put this out. I'll have pictures of them and maybe video of them if I can get them working here. But TRS-80 and Coco, 1983, that was the original. It looks good for the time, especially the Coco version. There's different graphics levels of them. The Dragon 32 and the Dragon 64, which were akin to the TRS-80 and Coco, they have unique versions for their own machines. They didn't use the same versions. The Atari ST is this one. This is the one that allowed them to put everything in they wanted to. About 3 years later, the Amiga version came out. They said it was graphically enhanced and it got good reviews. I have a review of it to read in a second. And DOS, it's VGA. It looks like the Amiga. It also has an EGA and CGA versions that are ugly. The EGA is like an ugly version of the Atari ST. Now, if you can read this, this is what the Games Machine UK said about the Amiga version. They never did an ST review, but this is what they said about the Amiga version.
The Atari ST version of Time Bandit is knocking around on the years, but is considered to be a classic. The Amiga version doesn't significantly improve over it, but that's by no means a bad thing. The graphics are colorful with some small and nicely detailed sprites. Watch for the expression of surprise when you blast the bouncing heads, but generally they aren't outstanding. The sound is also weak and could well prejudice Amiga owners who tend to expect their game to be visually and orally loud. However, Time Bandit has two things which are lacking in many Amiga games at the moment. Playability and depth. The action is fast and furious, with a host of hostiles to blow into oblivion. Complementing the shooting element is a text adventure and a Pac-Man game. There are also puzzles to solve, objects to collect, signs to read, tasks to complete. The depth is incredible. Time Bandit is a tough and challenging game, but offers the player great rewards if he's willing to persevere. Look it up if you think you can take the pace. So I agree with this.
Yeah, what do you think of that review? Because
I think it's a good review. I think it makes sense. I think in hindsight, there's a couple things that we can talk about later about why I think it's tough to recommend this to people now, but we'll talk about it.
Well, we are there now, Steve. So let's hear Steve's take.
Okay, so it's in one word, which is two words pushed together, genre busting. Crazy good for how early it came out. Sounds are from Better Dead Than Alien, or some of them are. Sprites are amazing. Mixes parts of so many popular games, a scrolling map and monster generators, action like Wizard of War, puzzles like Chip's Challenge, text parts like Scott Adams Adventures, Pac-Man levels. I think this game was the main influence on Jeff's Pumpkin Man series of games, which I think is true. Would be better remembered if it had save features and was not a strict arcade game with a high score table. Exactly. So that is kind of what I love this. I think it in some ways it's very, very similar to me to how I feel about Lost Dutchman Mine. Okay.
Really quick, because I've talked a lot about this already, the levels are labeled 1A to 4D. That's 16 levels in each of the 16 lands. Some of the lands are entered to not by choice, but by being chased. Example, the bomb one. It looks like it started as Gauntlet, and then they said, hey, let's throw in all the game ideas we ever had. But it's kind of twitchy with adventure elements, which is a strange but nice combo. There are no RPG elements, though, and only a single inventory key slot.
Legacy. This is Bill Dunleavy's only ST game. He also worked on a DOS Amiga version and a whole slew of TRS-80 games. Harry Lafner worked on Pinball Factory and 8-Ball for Mictron, plus Major Motion for the Amiga and Time Bandit for the Dragon 32. So they worked on a bunch of stuff. But to me, this is Bill Dunleavy's magnum opus.
Right. Here's our discussion point on this game and probably all the games going up. Because what I see on the internet and all these podcasts is a distinct change and maybe not a recognition of computer game advances when it comes to console games, talking about like when Jeremy Parrish does this stuff or the Retronauts do this. They kind of have gone back a little bit in their hindsight and said, oh, look at Impossible Mission. That's kind of NES-like, right? So they do a little bit of it. But because computer games were so niche, even Commodore 64 games were niche, people don't recognize some of the advances that were made before. Is this a game that is good enough for NES and beyond game players to enjoy? That's the point here.
I'll say there are three games that I think define, or maybe four, define what an NES game is that a older video game was not, right? And that would be Super Mario Brothers. Mm-hmm. That would be Legend of Zelda. Mm-hmm. That'd be Metroid, which I'm not really a fan. I never really played, but I know people love it as an action-adventure game. Or Metroidvania, whatever you want to call it. And then I would also, the fourth one would be Dragon Quest.
What about Castlevania, though? So is Metroid a Castlevania? Sure. Is Metroid... Metroid and Castlevania are basically in the same...
Sure.
Okay. For so a Metroidvania
those,
game.
Yeah. So if you take those genres, which really... And there's many more, but like... They did some things very interesting, like obviously Zelda had a save slot. You could play the game longer than just one sitting, right? Same, Super Mario Brothers was really, really hard, but it had all these secret things that made you want to keep coming back. Very satisfying to be able to play that game. I think that, and then obviously, like a Dragon Quest is an actual RPG with save slots and stuff that they could never do. They rarely, if ever, did on a console before that. I say rarely only because I don't want to say maybe there was something.
Yeah, there probably was something like that.
Dragon Stomper, you couldn't save, so you had to play it all in one sitting. Unfortunately, this game falls into the original category in that it's got a high score list, which really no one cares about score past 1986, really, right? It's more about completion. It's more about the story. It's less about just a score. Also, this game is super hard. And like you said, there's no real RPG elements or ways to make yourself better. You really just pick up one item, which is a key, and you have the same shots the whole time. But there's a lot of it, right? There's a huge amount of this game. There's 256 levels or whatever, and they're all different. If there had been a way to save, and I know you can replicate this now by just having doing the unlimited lives and then using the save state in your emulator, I think it's there. But for what it is when it was released, it was amazing, but it wasn't different enough to it would not interest those gamers.
I kind
gamers,
of agree. I do think this is an essential Atari ST game. This is a game that should be on an ST Mini.
Sure.
Essential ST game in that it came out early on. These guys pushed the envelope for games past what was on the 8-bits in a really early game, saying, wow, look at all this space. They used the space and made lots of little levels and lots of really fun stuff and threw in all their game ideas. But it's still, all the game ideas are still rooted in games that came out before 1985, right? The new ideas is, there's no ideas that advance game design. That's not to say it's not a hell of a game, right? Like, it's not a hell of a game.
No, it's essential in that it is, it's an in-betweener. Kind of, again, in-betweener. I was going to say, kind of reminds me a little bit of how I feel about Lost Dutchman Mine.
Right.
Which is, what is like a little RPG. It's more like a CinemaWare game where you've got these little arcade-y mini games in your, in what you're trying to do. That's, but Lost Dutchman Mine also is one of the games where, like, if it was made on the NES or Sega or something afterwards, the game would have had much different elements to it.
Right.
It would have been more attuned to being the, our little mini games would have been better mini games, most likely, because you weren't just using a mouse. But it's still essential game. I mean, we're not going to do essential Lost Dutchman Mine because we already have a whole movie about it. But or maybe we can. It's just like I couldn't recommend Lost Dutchman Mine to someone, to a gamer from this age, because they wouldn't get it. I can't recommend this game either. It's for me, it's great, and I just can't recommend it to say, if they look at it and be like, what is this? Like kind of not understanding the evolution, if that makes sense.
Would you recommend it? I would recommend it to any computer gamer from this age, though.
Sure. As a historical piece, I mean, again, it's, it to me, with the poem and everything, this is Bill Dunleavy and maybe to some extent Harry Lafner putting their heart on the page. I mean, like, from that standpoint, you can see everything they wanted to put into it. It is a piece of, it's a work of art, right? I even find it a fun game to play too myself.
I love it. Yeah,
I think that, but to play it, if you were going to put this on an ST collection, you would definitely add an autosave and an unlimited lives so that you can play through the whole game and see the whole thing.
It has a lot of play value, but it still doesn't, it doesn't mature above a quarters you would throw into an arcade machine. Yep, because the way it's built, it could be a quarter muncher.
It's got one foot in the past and one foot in the future. And unfortunately, that era of one foot in the past and one foot in the future is where you get all these lost PC games.
Right.
You know, you get your Zorros and your Karate Kids and your Ghostbusters and all these games that came out in 84, 85, 86 that no one remembers as these great games that push the envelope, but just not enough.
The reason they came out on the Commodore 64, the Atari ST, the Amiga, and a bunch of British computers.
So Atari 8-bit for some of them.
Some of them, right. I mean, but they came out in a time when games were shunned for other things. Video games were shunned for other things. Computer enthusiasts were dirt beneath somebody's shoes, right? I mean, like, you didn't even admit to having a computer.
David, I have this article where they're talking about selling the Atari ST and who they're selling it to. And they're like, oh, we really need to get home computer user, like their general purpose home computer user. And the guy says, what about the enthusiasts? He's like, oh, the enthusiasts will love it, but they're worthless or something. Just like,
right.
Like,
and those are the only
computer
people who bought the
enthusiasts
machine.
They just did not give a shit about.
Right. They wanted to somehow get home and personal computer at the time were like business users. Until the NES revived gaming, and it's longer than people think. So 1984 all the way until 1986, there's 2 years, which in our formative time as being a 13 to 16-year-old or 14 to 16-year-old was an eternity.
It's not even. It's even longer than that, though, because the NES comes out in, like, winter 1985, but only in New York. But it really doesn't roll out till Christmas 1986. Most people get it, right? That's when Super Mario Brothers comes out earlier, a little bit earlier that year. That's what, and they package Super Mario Brothers. I was looking at these ads the other day. I'm like, oh my God, Atari had no chance. They packaged the console, Super Mario Brothers, and the controllers for $79.99. The $1,700 was the same price. Like, Jack Tramiel had no freaking chance against that. There's no way.
With Pole Position 2 as the pack-in. Not a bad game at all, but it's not a
didn't
not
even
a
matter that it was the pack-in. It's just, he also was trying to market the XEGS at the same time. Like you couldn't even get a story straight about what you've got one amazing thing that everybody wants for $79.99. The other guy's got three pieces of for various prices, $49, $79, $129. Who knew what you were buying if you're buying Atari?
Exactly.
But if they had got their story straight and they had good games to launch at the same time as a Nintendo, that winter of 1986, they could have had a chance, and they had something to compete with Mario. They could have had a chance, but they had no idea what they were doing because they didn't literally didn't care. It was just get rid of the inventory so we can fund our next memory upgrade for the ST.
So this game, going back to Pinebed for a second, because I agree, but I do think that ST is valuable because we're in an ST podcast, but I understand what they were doing. Valuable memory upgrade for the ST, it's great. But because it fell in those 3 years, right?
Yes. The 80, between 84, 85, I say anything that falls in 84, 85, and 86 up until November is really, no, there's like 3 years. That's almost a full school generation of kids that aren't, right. A high school generation that aren't playing video games.
That have no video game. They're not playing
video games. Or very little, right? Very little.
And that, it fell in those 3 years, and that's where you get that hybrid period where Super Mario Brothers has not taught you the crate button locations of jump and
that's right,
and fire, there's whatever, and they haven't created the actual game design concepts of you don't die on every hit, like all those things that have that Nintendo sort of is given the credit of creating, which fair or not, whatever, those weren't in vogue yet. And so you get all these games in the middle here that are sort of a nebulous version of maybe they got some of that, maybe they didn't, and this one falls directly in there.
I wouldn't say that Nintendo invented any of that stuff. They just perfected all this stuff and put it all together and also made the games really good. So yeah. That's what they got. And not that this isn't a good game, and not that Zorro and Bruce Lee and Karate Kid and all those other games that came out weren't also great games. They were, but they just didn't have the elements.
Right.
They just didn't have the perfected elements that would make people remember them.
Okay.
I think some of those actually came out of Nintendo too, by the way.
They did, but they came out afterwards. But
yeah.
So is Time Bandit an essential game for any Atari ST fan? I'd say so. It's certainly not without its faults, but it's definitely a must-play game on the system. As we discussed, while it doesn't really bridge the gap between the Crash and the NES, it kind of is a culmination of every pre-Crash game aesthetic rolled into one, faults and all. Taken as a pure action game, I do think some NES and beyond console gamers might get a kick out of it, but only for a short while. Well, Steve, that is the first essential podcast of the Essential ST.
So this game is essential, though. I think if you want to know what the ST was about, you've got to play this game.
This is one of the essential games. Okay. Until next time, into the vertical blank.
Into the vertical blank.
We were children of the Silicon Revolution, an X generation conscripted to fight the console and home computer wars. A product of an analog 70s childhood, we came of digital age in the 80s, believing we could affect the world 8 bits at a time. Armed with joysticks, full-stroke keyboards, Jolt Cola, and MTV haircuts, we proceeded into the vertical blank. There, we stayed up late at night, devising incantations from D&D rulebooks and beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code. Video games were the match, and programming was the fuse, as the infinite possibilities of the digital world exploded into the internet age to come. We are Generation Atari.
Into the vertical blank.